Buddy. Hi. It's wonderful to see you all here. Thank you so much for joining us for this special conversation that's taking place in the Urbanisation Planning, Development and Human Geography seminar series, the MSc Department of Geography and Environment. I'm beyond thrilled to be sitting here with Professor Pat Noxolo and Professor Laura Pulido. And what we're going to do here is have a conversation about transnational geographies of race. There's a couple of things I want to explain before I properly introduce our speakers. The first is that because this is a conversation, what we've asked Pat and Laura to do is to provide questions to each other. So the majority of this discussion is going to be a discussion between Pat and Laura, and they propose the questions to each other, and we'll have that discussion. After that, the floor will be open to questions from the audience. However, today we are going to be somewhat disrupted because of the walkout at 12 o'clock in support of Palestine. Therefore, we will rise and leave at 12 o'clock, and you're welcome to join us. There is a student demonstration on the LSE Plaza. We will reconvene, but we won't be able to reconvene in this room. We will reconvene in CLM 202 at 1 o'clock. So the second half of the seminar will take place then. If you would like to post questions to our speakers that I can post for you, if you can't be here at the second hour, you can email them to our colleagues at geog.coms. That's geog.coms with two M's. At lse.ac.uk. So I would like to move on to introduce our speakers. Professor Laura Pulido is currently a centennial professor in the department. She's also the Collins Chair and Professor of Indigenous Race and Ethnic Studies and Geography at the University of Oregon, and before that, she was professor at the University of Southern California for over two decades. She's a leading scholar of race, environmental justice, and cultural memory. Her work is primarily focused on the relationship of race, place, and economic dynamics, and how they're mutually constituting. Among her pioneering contributions to the field of human geography is an understanding of the structural conditions shaping environmental racism. She's the author or editor of six award-winning books, as well as dozens of articles and book chapters. And her most recent book projects include The Posthumous Collection by Clyde Woods, Development Drowned and Reborn, The Blues of Bourbon Restoration in Post-Katrina New Orleans, and with Josh Kuhn, Black and Brown in Los Angeles, Beyond the Conflict and Cooperation. And her most recent articles include the editorial introduction to the 2023 special issue of the Annals of the American Association of Geographers on Unsettling Race, Nature, and Environment in Geography, and the Urban Geography Plenary Lecture from the AAG 2022 on Cultural Memory, White Innocence, and United States Territory. She's been the recipient of several of the highest honors from the American Association of Geographers, including the Presidential Achievement Award, the Distinguished Scholarship Award, the Harold Rose Anti-Racism Award, the Meridian Book Award, and the Globe Book Award. She's also received fellowships and honors from the Guggenheim, Ford, Woodrow Wilson, Antipode, and National Science Foundations, as well as the National Endowment for the Humanities and American Geographical Society. And she contributes actively to contemporary policy debates about racial inequality and structural racism, for example, testifying at the United States Senate hearing on environmental justice in 2021. And more broadly, she's written about being a model practitioner of scholar activism, illuminating the possibilities and responsibilities of community-engaged scholarship. Pat Noxolo is a professor in human geography and chair in postcolonial geographies at the University of Birmingham. She's a leading scholar of postcolonial geography. Her work spans international development, culture, and in/security, and she's pioneered the use of postcolonial discursive and literary approaches to explore the spatialities of Caribbean and British cultural practices, including dance and literature. She's the lead researcher on the Caribbean Securities and Creativity Research Network, funded by the Leaving You Trust, and on the Creative Approaches to Race and Insecurity, funded by the Arts and Humanities Research Council. In her most recent work, Pat has written on Black geographies, centering Black spatial thought and agency. She is the co-editor of the 2022 collection Dance Hall Insecurities, Perspectives on Caribbean Expressive Life with P. Hatton and Sonja N. Stanley Mia, published by Routledge. And she's currently writing the progress reports for Progress in Human Geography on geographies of race and ethnicity. Her work has been recognised with the award in 2021 of the Royal Geographical Society Murchison Award for publications judged to contribute most to geographical science in preceding years, particularly through reconceptualising spatial ethics through place-based practices and her effective advocating of post-colonial and decolonial thought in geography and beyond. And she most recently delivered the 2023 Singapore Journal of Tropical Geography annual lecture at the RGSIBG conference on quantum black creative geographies as climate change geographies. She was co-editor until this year of Transactions of the Institute of British Geographers, during which time she curated a series of papers on black British geography. She's also a founding member of the Race, Culture and Equality Working Group of the Royal Geographical Society, and she has chaired the Society of Caribbean Studies in the UK. Pat and Laura, huge welcome. We're absolutely delighted to be here with you in the conversation. And I think we have a question from Pat to Laura first.
Well, I just want to say how brilliant it is to be here. And thank you so much for inviting me and for turning up to listen to this discussion. I've honestly just been really looking forward to it so much. Slightly intimidated, fangirl.
I'm a bit like, okay, don't ask stupid questions. But I just want to say how
excited I am to be part of this conversation, how much I'm looking forward to what you've got to say. So I'll start with a question that seems particularly relevant today in terms of the walk out, the ceasefire. So your work keeps a consistent focus on academic work with activism. What brought you in the first place to that position to be a scholar activist? And is it becoming more difficult to maintain this balance?
Yeah, so I thank you for that question. And I also want to say how happy I am to be here and have the opportunity to meet Pat.
It's great.
So I started, I think I was an activist first before I was a scholar, I would say that. And so, and I was angry. And I was very acutely aware of the invisibility, or what I saw to be invisibility, like in my case, particularly like in terms of thinking about the activism of working class, you know, Latinos in the United States, especially like in a place like Los Angeles, which has such a large, you know, a Latinx population. And so, you know, my activism started in school, and then I began studying activism, actually, then for my dissertation. I was studying social movements and activism. And then it was a really easy alignment, let me put it that way at first. It was a very easy alignment between, let me study activism and be embedded in activism, right? So I was kind of like constantly doing like an ethnography of my life and the different struggles that I was involved in. And that was a very rich, robust, and really enjoyable period of my life. One important thing I'll say is I didn't have kids. So I was able to do that. And it changed for a couple of reasons. One of the reasons it changed is I became involved in a struggle on my campus where the workers were trying to unionize, or one was trying to fight against subcontracting union workers. And I became very involved in this. And this was the first time I actually then became involved in campus politics. So that was a shift, because I was explicitly on the side of the workers. And, you know, you have to come face to face then with the administration. And that was a shift. From that, I then became more involved actually in campus struggles, particularly around the lack of transparency around tenure issues at the University of Southern California, who is notorious for being a private, kind of closed door institution. So I became involved in a number of struggles around that place, and ultimately found it completely intolerable to be there, given the nature of that institution. And then eventually I had kids, and that changed too. I mean, I didn't realize until I had children the amount of emotional energy and resources it takes to be that kind of frontline activist, right? It's tremendous, and I simply could not do it once I had children. And so at that point, both my research shifted a bit, becoming more archival in different kinds of ways, less ethnographic, but also then much more involved in terms of campus politics as well, which I continue to be involved in my current institution. Yeah.
I guess when I was thinking about that question, I mean, it's your work is incredibly rich and on the button in terms of you can see over time the sorts of shifts in relation to what's going on in the world, you know, kind of the moves to think about, you know, particular places and spaces and how they, what's required to enable Latina and Black life within US cities. And I guess I wondered about the relationships between the analyses that you were doing and that, and obviously you needed to respond to what was happening. So the relationships between the analyses that you were doing and the sorts of activism that you were able to stage, I wondered whether it was kind of going, your activism began to go more into your analyses as a contribution to the activism, or whether it was possible to stay on streets with it and bring that into your analysis.
Thank you. I think that's really, that is true. Thank you for that insight so I can understand myself better. You know, as I became older or evolved as a scholar and became a more mature scholar, you know, I found my voice. And I think both of us have really powerful, strong voices, right? I think yours is really loud and clear. And mine is too. And I prioritize increasingly writing for a popular audience, and not just writing for scholars. So I think that's very important. And I have been gratified in terms that people, you know, non-academics do read my work, at least some of them. And so I felt that was really important to bring to bear a lens, like, how do we understand what's happening today? And I think about this article I wrote, like, on Flint, Michigan, in terms of the poison that was happening. And the people that contacted me from the community, people like lawyers, like, oh my gosh, thank you so much for this analysis. This is really helpful to us. So I realized, oh, I can do that and have kids. And so that's one of the ways. I think you're right. And I also began doing much more explicitly popular work, like The People's Guide to Los Angeles. That's a book series now that was explicitly meant for a popular audience. You know, in your case, Pat, I don't know how you define yourself in terms of a scholar activist. So that'd be one of the questions that I have. But then, like, I look, you know, like on your website, and I see, like, is it Fee Wide? Fee
Road. It's a Jamaican thing.
Okay. And I thought, my gosh, this is amazing. What the stuff that you've done around art and dancing. And so, how do you see yourself in this way?
Yeah, that's a really. Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I guess I see myself as a change maker, which is an activist role. I'm not someone who's been in protests very much. I'm not somebody who's done that kind of politics, not because I have anything against or any problem with walking out, but because I guess I've always felt that my position in the academy was extremely precarious, and that there weren't very many of me, you know, in the academy. So I felt like being here and staying here was always political. And it is for any woman, and it is for any Black person, and it is for any person of color, right? Just being here, speaking up and not staying silent, really important. Taking the students who nobody else wants, or who they say are difficult, which really always makes me laugh. I'm kind of like, I remember having a conversation with one woman who, a recent PhD student, I said, oh, you know, because this student needs shit handling, and the woman said, oh yeah, very difficult.
I said, no.
Needs some support. She can find things difficult.
That's where I was going. So kind of being there, and I think for other people to know that you're still there
is quite important, ongoing, everyday kind of activism. So I've considered that quite important. And also things that seem to... So I work at a university, which I've expressed before, is quite heavily armoured. I mean, it's in the middle of Birmingham, right up the road from where I grew up. I know what our community is, and we've managed successfully over 100 years to keep most of that community out. Mm-hmm. You've got to be really organised to keep most of that community out in a place like Birmingham. Mm-hmm. So I guess I've increasingly tried to use my position to say, you know, let's go out, see what people are doing, have conversations. I haven't so much taken an ethnography approach. I've more sort of taken a collaboration, dialogic approach. You know, what are you doing? Come and have a chat with me. Really creative stuff. Let's see if we can enable it. All of that kind of work. Trying to get more voices into the British academic environment in terms of events, in terms of exhibitions, performances, in dialogue with a range of academic voices. So I kind of seen my work as being as about enlarging the academy, but it's also about redistributing what's in the academy, right? All that colonial wealth that's just kind of kept within the academy. And obviously you're going to defend that. I mean, it's wealth. So you're going to, you know, you're going to defend it and not want, you want as few as people as possible to be able to take part in that wealth. You know, that's how distribution works in colonialist circumstances. So my priority in terms of activism has always been kind of, okay, let's get that money in. Now, how can we distribute it? Mm-hmm. Who can we bring in? Who can we hire to do things? I never want people to work for nothing, because that's another form of exploitation at universities. Really are strongly, they always want people to come and work for nothing. Mm-hmm. And in the present gig economy, it's impossible for people to come and work for nothing, and they're not tenured. So the Phoebe Road internship is part of that, a sort of paid internship for Black job undergraduates over a summer to come and have conversations with people like me whose work they've read, who they kind of know, this is somebody that I could be, you know. Also to talk with PhD students, to be mentored by PhD students, early career Black scholars, you know, to get that sense that they connect not only with them, but also with each other, because the situation in geography in the UK is that it's very likely that you'll be the only Black undergraduate in a course where there can be really large courses. There can be like 600-700 people on the course, and you're the only one, or you're the only one that you see, right? Because you might be on the human geography side, and then the only other one is on the physical geography side, so you don't see them. And so that sort of sense that, wow, I'm a real anomaly, I don't really belong, is a really sort of strong feeling. So the Phoebe Road internships, we're now in this was our third year. And I think it's kind of picking up speed in terms of not only the people that eventually get chosen every year. It's not a lot of people that apply, because there just aren't a lot of Black geography undergraduates, but there's more and more, a more intense kind of competition for those places, because we want to keep it very small, and we didn't want to extend it out to people of colour, because in the UK, in this post-colonial situation, I think there are huge differences in the levels of integration into the academy of people coming different colonial routes. Mm-hmm. And so I felt it was very important that it stayed Black geography. Mm-hmm. There's a whole kind of history of equal opportunities in the UK, where any kinds of concessions that get brought about through through oppression of the dark then get kind of filtered up to the ones who have the resources to be able to compete for those resources.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I don't want to say anything divisive here. I'm not saying anything divisive. I just think it's important that some initiatives are Black initiatives in that context. So this particular one, definitely. That doesn't mean that that's how I do all my politics, but this one. So it's kind of building its steam. And what my hope is that even for those who don't apply, they know it's there.
Yeah.
So they know that every year there's at least 5 Black geography undergraduates. They know that there is a competition for places, so there must be more than those 5 every year. And that puts them in a better position than I was, you know, back in the 90s when I just thought, well, they're all the Black people. Just not in geography. I think there always probably were some, you know, but it's just quite difficult to find each other. So it's got that sort of sense of finding each other, but also that sort of freeing up futures is what I wanted to do. Kind of, it's Phoebe Road, it's our road in the kind of Jamaican part where it's Phoebe Road is ours. So we have to take a particular, our own road. I don't want it to be the sort of scheme where we learn how to be white, which I think a lot of mentoring schemes are that way. Mm-hmm. You know, similarly for women, you know, you learn how to be more man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, both of those places, pregnant, you know, all these kinds of things. Whereas actually I don't want it to be that. I want to see what the interns want to do, what kind of thing they want to create. So yeah, I guess those kinds of activism are they are quite confronting, they're quite contestatory. They do reach out for the public, for sure. But I think there's just a lot of ways of because there's a lot of change that's required.
Right. So that, you know, there's a lot of different things to do.
Yeah.
I'd like to, if I could pick up on something you said, because this is something I think a lot about these days, and that is thinking about racial politics in terms of, you know, precisely things that you said, because it's very similar to the United States. When we develop like a people of color politics, you know, what that has meant for Black people. Right. And I like the way you put it, those who have more, I think, is it like capacity or more kind of are more able to avail themselves those opportunities do so. And, you know, that's really, it's true. It's very true. And so I feel like this is an interesting moment and juncture, you know, in terms of how do we still kind of foreground or be attentive to the pervasive and fundamental nature of anti-Blackness, both globally and in the US, for like in my case, while still being attentive to building a larger kind of anti-racist kind of movement.
I think it's a huge question, and I guess I'm trying to avoid the kind of thing that says, you know, if you're not Black, then I'm not interested in you.
Because I don't think that that's the history of my career.
I've been involved with feminist geographers, and they have been very involved with me, very supportive. It's been Black and Asian geographers in the race group that have really enabled me to stay. So the reality for me in my life and career has not been that it's, you know, a sort of exclusive Black movement. But by the same token, I do think that there are moments where you have to say, actually, we do need to address anti-Blackness just on its own. I don't think that necessarily means we can't do anything else, but there are moments to create a call.
Where is Tom Cook? So we will reconvene at 1 PM and see you on the motive. Thank you so much for joining us again. It's really great to see you all here. So we're going to continue our discussion with Pat and Laura.
And I think we're going to continue with a discussion about connections to place. And I think, Laura, you had a question that you wanted to pose to Pat.
Thank you. First, I want to say thank you, everybody, for coming back. I was questioning whether anybody would. That's very committed, so I appreciate that very much. So in preparing for this, you know, I read a bunch of Pat's work, and it really jumped out at me really quickly, the extent to which her deep engagement, entanglement, identification with the Caribbean, right? Deep attachment to place. And so, and she writes about it, you write about it, so mm-hmm. eloquently, I felt. I was very moved a lot by it. So I guess one of the things that I noticed is, again, your voice in relationship to place and how you express that. And I also wanted to, you know, and you talk about also how it's changed over time. So I'd like to hear how you see right now your relationship to the Caribbean and how you are in conversation with it.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, that as we were sort of talking about a little bit before the walkout, that that idea of conversation is something that I've kind of worked with in relation to sort of Stuart Hall's work in particular, where he talks about unending conversations and conversations that carry on, and conversations that he's had with a number of different people, and has this sort of sense of out of conversations come really important political commitments of various kinds. And I think it also sort of really encapsulates Stuart Hall's sort of sense of how we do identity. It's a lighter hold on identity than the idea that, you know, we kind of have an identity or somehow possess an identity, but that we're always in conversation with different elements of our identity, and our identities mm-hmm. are something that we're also in conversation with in a sort of, you know, that sort of construction of who we are on a day-to-day basis, that process of identification can be understood as a conversation. You know, where that sort of thing where you sort of notice an element of yourself that you hadn't noticed before, and not necessarily to see that as, oh dear, I didn't realise I was that way, but sort of also to kind of, you know, think, well, actually, yeah, I am a bit that way, and maybe I could change that, you know, maybe I could not be that way. And I've been thinking about it in that fairly sort of loose way around identity and identification as I'm getting older. I mean, I'm getting towards 60, and at 60 seems, it's not important, but it seems important. You know, it's one of those kind of things. And I guess my husband and I have been having conversations about retirement because he works in quite a challenging school and he's about ready. So we're sort of having these conversations about getting older. And it's made me think about identity. It's made me think about how do I hold my identity? What kind of older woman do I want to be? And in Caribbean traditions, older women are really important, you know. Older women carry the culture in lots of really interesting ways. There's this really really lovely position of auntie. It's not really a powerful position, although people do listen to aunties. But it's more of a, now that I'm kind of your auntie, you have a certain respect for me. You wouldn't see me standing up for a long time and not give me a chair, that kind of respect. But you also have that sort of expectation that if you were hungry, I might feed you, that kind of auntie thing. So there's a lot of, there's responsibility in being an auntie, and I find that quite delightful. You know, I love it when the younger black person says to me, you know, auntie, come sit. You know, that kind of, I really like that. I like that we have that connection, that my age and my grey hair means that they can have a particular kind of relationship with me. And I've always been somebody that's been very fortunate to have really good aunties. You know, like, obviously my kind of blood aunties, but also aunties that I've met when I went and did my year abroad in France as part of my French degree. someone just knocked on the door, a really lovely woman called Marie-Françoise, and every year she knocks on the door of the assistant of that school and invites them for dinner. So I kind of had a ready-made auntie. And I guess that it's that kind of conversation with myself to say, what kind of auntie am I now? You know, am I fulfilling that auntie role? What does that auntie role look like in academia? That's something that I'm starting to think about in terms of black geographies. How am I black in the academy? What does that auntie role look like? How can I be an auntie in the way that I think an auntie should be? Both to black students who I think more expect it or more readily move into that relationship. So the interns that we were talking about before we walked out, those interns, the Fury Road interns, there's a nice kind of anti-relationship with them. In fact, one of them said, I don't feel comfortable calling you Pat. I don't feel comfortable. Can I just call you Auntie? And I said, yeah, that's lovely, yeah, call me Auntie. You know, but I really like that. But then I'm also thinking of my other students, my third year students in particular, because, you know, you get to have more conversations with them, you know, kind of, I like to move into that auntie role. I like to sort of say to them, you know, do your best, but don't stress out too much. You know, make sure you eat, make sure you sleep, you know, all those things that aunties can say to you that you think, oh, auntie, put your coat on, all those things. I like to sort of feel that lecturers should have a responsibility relationship with our students. And that politically is quite important. It's a commodification type, anti-commodity relationship with our students, and that seems quite important to me, because we seem to expect our students to support us, you know, in strikes and various things, but we don't seem to. It's a two-way relationship, an anti-relationship, you know, and we need to have responsibility towards them as well, and that can take a number of different forms, right? But I think it's about standing up for each other in lots of different ways. So conversation is about identity, but that, I guess, in relation to the Caribbean specifically, I do have quite a sort of complicated relationship to the Caribbean, I guess. I wasn't brought up there, I wasn't born there, but I was born in Birmingham. My parents are from Jamaica. They arrived in around 1960 and then had five children. My eldest sister was born in Jamaica. My brother was born, eldest brother was born just after my mother came to Jamaica. Sort of chagrin, he would have loved to have been born in Jamaica. And then the youngest three of us were born here. We were not a wealthy family, quite low income, and obviously when you've got five children, you can't just be taking them to Jamaica every 5 minutes, it's very expensive. And so I didn't actually go to Jamaica until I was an adult. Mm-hmm. Went with my sister. And so, you know, it was great meeting family, you know, seeing where my mum and dad grew up, because as the child of migrants, you have a sort of vision or echo of where they came from, and you know that it formed them in ways that you find difficult to understand, because you know that it's a very different place and a very different way of being, and so it was really interesting to go. During my PhD, I then went to Barbados for a few months. We're not from Barbados at all, but it was really interesting to see another Caribbean island and to get a sense of what is the Caribbean, or, you know, in terms of all of its islands and its all of its spaces, and how Barbados is in many ways quite different to Jamaica, how they also define themselves. Jamaicans define themselves against Barbadians, and Barbadians against not anti, but different. We're different from. All of that was really interesting, but I'm very aware, and I've never wanted to usurp the idea of being Caribbean. So to say, I am Caribbean, I will say I'm Caribbean heritage. And some people would see that as a rejection of the Caribbean, but I don't at all. I just think, I feel like if I said I was Caribbean, then I would be saying that I have been formed out of those circumstances and had to confront some of those struggles. And obviously, I do have to confront some of those struggles or the echoes of those struggles in the UK, but it's not the same as growing up in the Caribbean. And so you don't have the same challenges, but you also don't have the same sweetnesses. You're just not the same person mm-hmm. as you would be if you were born there. So my brother puts it quite well. He says, we don't have the full set of keys. I really like that. You know, there's some doors that are open to me and some doors that are closed. And so it's kind of like there's a conversation with Caribbean identity and with the idea of the Caribbean that for me has been a lifelong thing. And I think it usually is or often is for the sons and daughters of migrants. You know, you have, because you are to some extent, you're formed by people who were formed in the Caribbean. And so you are formed by your parents and your community and, you know, all those uncles whose kind of really rich voices, I just remember them rumbling in their chest, you know, sitting on laps and them have their voices rumbling in their chest. And that to me is a big part of how I understand masculinity and what, you know, what I find attractive and all of those kinds of things is to do with that sort of self-care, black aesthetics, all of those kinds of things that are very much part of Caribbean identity. And those wonderful aunties, their incredible beauty and style, the feeding, you know, all of those things are part of who I am. And it's really important to me when I confront, I am also very British, and I recognise that, recognised it very fully when I went to Ghana, because I was just kind of so British. People weren't queuing, oh my gosh, you know. It's just kind of like really, really. So I really confronted at that time I hadn't really thought of myself as particularly British. I was like 22. I hadn't really, and you know, being brought up in Birmingham, people still talked about second generation immigrants at that time. So I didn't really think, I thought, well, I don't really fit here. And so I had wanted to see Africa, you know. So when I first went to Ghana, I sort of thought, actually, no, I really am quite British. Yeah. Students would, because I taught in a school, and students would imitate my walk, because it's a kind of uptight walk. It's not so, you know, they thought it was a very British walk. You know, I kind of went, walk straight, whereas their women kind of walk side to side, you know, and I could see what they were saying. I could see it. And so they would be like, well, it's a Miss Patton walk, because that was my thing. I thought that was really funny, but I kind of, yeah, I think I did realise how British I am, but then I also, at the heart of Britishness in the university system, I can see how black I am in a Caribbean-inflected way. Mm-hmm. So it means that I'm sort of, it's conversation because you're always the other person, you're always the interlocutor in whichever conversation you're having, right? So, you know, in conversation with people who are born and brought up in the Caribbean, there's lots of things that we have in common, but I'm also not the same. So I'm always aware of my difference. I'm always aware of being an interlocutor in relation to Caribbeanness. But here in the UK, I'm always aware that I'm British with a Caribbean inflection, which is something very particular, right? Sure. Because the Caribbean and Britain have had the longest colonial relationship. So they are formed out of each other. Mm-hmm. And Britishness and Caribbeanness are by no means exclusive. Right? So there's that kind of really interesting interlocutor thing where we actually are quite close. A kind of conversation with a twin almost, you know, mm-hmm. that kind of. Mm-hmm. And that I think is really interesting. So my relationship with the Caribbean is always changing and maturing as time goes on, but I think there's a lot of mileage in the idea of the conversation, things to carry on working on. It's not a really long answer, sorry.
I see lots of parallels in what you're saying in terms of like the work, like in Chicano and Chicanx studies in relationship to Mexico. Mm. And one of the things that some scholars have been talking about is that, particularly in terms of indigeneity for like, the Mexican origin, or you know, Mexican American population, another term for it, is one of loss.
Yeah, okay.
Of loss. And I'm wondering if that resonates for you at all.
Yeah, it's really interesting actually. Because, I mean, obviously, that Mexican American border that's a really very specific thing, about loss and about kind of being the whole militarization of being kept out in that way is very, very physical across that border, and then all of the stuff that the conversations about that. Here in the UK, the Caribbean identity has been, there has been a similar borderization against against Caribbean migration. From that moment when my parents came, when Commonwealth migration was actually somewhat encouraged, to all of those sorts of moments where the Nationality Acts were changed to say, oh, you had to have a grandparent, you know, and this sort of exclusion of various roles, to the point now where it's, you know, you need a sponsor and people are being sent back with criminal records. Any criminality, you get sent back. You know, David Cameron, our former Prime Minister, you know, helping to build a huge prison in Jamaica, you know, partly for the people who were sent back, you know, so there's that criminalization, and which I do think has some parallels with that Mexican-US border and the criminalization of Mexicans entering the US. So there are some kinds of resonances around the idea of exclusion. But I guess there's something very particular. There's something very particular about the US state, of course, and that, and you know, it has its own. I'd be really interested to hear what you have to say about that. And there's something very particular about the British state and the way in which it deals with its imperial leftovers, How does it deal with them? And it often is about kind of, well, let's kind of lock that off, pretend it never had anything much to do with us, and send it back home. And there's quite a lot of that's a kind of ongoing thread in the discussion about the empire and what we do about it, which has to do with being at the heart of an empire, which I think is probably a different conversation to the US.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
So there are some who would argue the US is an empire. In terms of, we think about it, obviously, from a native indigenous perspective, right, how it came to be, and then the whole relationship, you know, through the Mexican-American War and, like, you know, taking the northern half of Mexico, right? So there is that. And there have been, like, over time, like, in terms of U.S. history, like, periodic waves of also of deportations, of mass deportations, like, against Mexicans at various points in time, going back at least until the 1930s. You know, going on almost a century now, we've had those. My family was deported during the, and they were, at least some of them were, they were citizens, I believe, and at the time, and they were deported during the Great Depression.
Right.
You know, so that happens. And so, but when I think about the idea of loss, like some people have been talking about it as, you know, it's this, as you're talking here, it's about having a very complicated subjectivity within the United States in terms of not only the racial formation, but also the nation, right? And what is your relationship to it? And it's in, you know, you're in between the spaces, right? As well as in terms of like indigeneity, the severing of that through layers of colonization. So and it's different, obviously, right? In terms of like Spanish colonization and then the US, you know, displacement and things that have happened over time. So I feel there's like always this, for many of the Mexican origin populations that desire to connect, but the difficulties in doing that as well, because you're also very American, right? As you're saying, and you don't know that exactly like you say until you go there. And it's very clear.
Yeah. I think that's that idea of loss is really interesting. I feel Stuart Hall once. I only saw him once in live, and he was at Nottingham Playhouse doing an evening with Stuart Hall, and he sort of was at that point very elderly. He kind of went on stage with stick and then sat in his chair and then just filled the room with his personality. But I remember him saying, you know, everybody else is retreating from Britishness, and we migrants, we all want it. We're the last people who want to hold onto Britishness. The Scots don't want it, the Irish don't want it, but the rest of us were jumping onto this Britishness. And I think that that's very true. That idea of loss is a really interesting one, but I feel like, from my vantage point, it doesn't quite resonate, because we are just constantly, we won't be lost. We're just constantly holding on to, grabbing onto this Britishness,
yes,
in a way where we feel it quite integrally as part of our identity. My dad, who passed away last year, very much had, some of his earliest memories are coronations.
Oh, wow, yeah.
The George the whatever, and, you know, the kind of little coronation tins that you get given, and, you know, all this. So he remembers all of that when he was at school, and the way they had, like, big celebrations and jubilees and camps. And so he navigated a certain kind of Britishness. Not that he necessarily was, it was complicated, but it was part of his formation in the way that the British did empire. You know, they kind of, they did that overseas almost more than within the UK. You know, it was kind of like, it was very important to entrench that sense of Britishness. And so that becomes part of his Caribbeanness, is British inflected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's quite important to who he is. And I know when I talk to Caribbean people who were French Empire, then their Caribbeanness is French inflected. So that sense of loss is probably not quite where we are. It's more because we can't lose it. It's kind of like quite embedded.
Can I pick up on this question about place? And Pat, you actually had a question for Laura about how she could keep the focus on the US and think about global challenges at the same time.
Yeah, so, you know, I've actually really admired how your work is very firmly in place, because that goes along with the activism that we were talking about before, right?
That's true.
It's very much linked with places in the US. So I wonder whether it's possible to address the really global challenges that we're all facing, where we do need to connect up, whilst also having that, maintaining that local flavour or local kind of embeddedness of your work.
So, I appreciate you making that connection between the activism and the place, because they absolutely were tied together. I was in Los Angeles. I love LA. It's in my DNA. It's in my blood. I look at the city, it's like, this is a family my family helped build. I look at the city, you know, in terms of they've been laborers in the city. And so that was a side of both my activism and scholarship. But that changed when I moved to Oregon. Mm. Well, two things happened that made me kind of move away. First, I posthumously completed Clyde Wood's book on New Orleans. So here I was, thrust into this situation of having to learn about a completely different place I knew very little about. And that was very challenging, and it was also a gift, right? Let's think beyond just LA, California. So that was good. And then I moved to Oregon. Mm-hmm. And so as part of my activism, early on in my dissertation work, I actually looked at two different kind of like case studies. One was in northern New Mexico, and one was in California. And I found both very interesting, exciting, so both deserving of my time and attention. But I realized I could not maintain my relationship with the one in New Mexico. Mm. And so I realized, okay, I'm not going to do that, because I can't do that. And but I am going to just focus here in California, where I'm at, because I can commit to that, right? Mm. And then I moved to Oregon. And I think by the time I moved to Oregon, is, again, this is after 23 years at USC. I kind of have been, I had really studied LA. I studied up and down, overtime. I mean, all, you know, I was, maybe I was about done with it. And two things happened at that time, and one of them is I began thinking more nationally, because as I was dissolving that tie to Los Angeles, I was like, well, how do I proceed as a geographer? What is going to be the scale and the subject of my research? And unbeknownst to me, I was being pushed to the nation. And again, this goes back to our conversation yesterday in Austin's class about like Clyde's work, who has been so formative in me and thinking more broadly. And the other thing that happened is I also began, and I suppose as I'm saying this now, there must have been a connection, but I wasn't aware of it. I was really focusing much more on shifting from focusing on activism and grassroots organizations, focusing more upward. So studying capital, the state, and white supremacy and how it operates. Okay. And I've stayed at that place. Okay. And the thing I have been focusing a lot of, thinking a lot about, I haven't written as much about as I would like, but is thinking about particularly about white nationalism in the United States and the way it impacts the rest of the world in terms of climate change. So it's not thinking at the bottom. It's not thinking about the amazing grassroots activism and connections that are happening through climate justice, but thinking about the way both the nation and the state are operating to engage in climate refusal. Because we are like the most powerful country in the world blocking climate action. And I've been making a list and collecting all these different moments of blockage that have been going back to the Tea Party movement, which develops in 2009, and like thinking about in these different historical moments, what has been relationship, what has of particularly white nationalism, and how that has contributed to blocking. So in that way, I'm trying to move a little bit more, thinking about it globally, because the ferocity, the energy, the breadth of U.S. white nationalism and supremacy is remarkable. Mm-hmm. And it spills over to the rest of the world in all kinds of unexpected ways.
No, that's fascinating. It's made me think about that. So I'm inviting the Jamaican filmmaker Esther Figueroa to come to Birmingham. If any of you are available, you're very happy to come. I'd be very happy to see you. She is coming, her film is called, to premiere a film called Fly Me to the Moon. And it's a film that's about bauxite extraction in Jamaica. And how that bauxite has been used to make aluminium. And then that aluminium was pivotal to the growth of US military action, particularly in relation to Vietnam and, and various other places, and also obviously the space program. So there's that real sense of kind of vertical geographies, you know, kind of digging that bauxite out of the ground and taking it into metal objects in the home and everything else, and then taking it upwards. But also kind of the refusal to recycle aluminium, right? Because you don't, instead of recycling it, you carry on digging it out of the ground, because all of that fuels a war effort, a military complex, which the US wants to keep going, right? Wants to keep going so that it can maintain it. So it's a really interesting film with a lot of ambition. We're screening on the 1st of December, if anybody wants to come. But I think it's also it made me think a lot about the particular position of the U.S. in relation to the rest of the world, that particular kind of set of responsibilities, but also that particular kind of the potential for damage. I mean, as Michael Manley said years ago, as president of Jamaica, you know, when the U.S. sneezes, everybody catches cold, right? Yeah. And that's always and still going to be the case. But as you say, in relation to climate change, that could mean that they would be an incredible leader of the response in relation to climate change, but there's that sort of tendency to actually fuel and lead the refusal to deal with climate change, and in this case, fuel and lead the refusal to stop digging these minerals out of the ground to promote food sovereignty by making companies be more responsible about the landscapes that they're devastating. Incredible power to do these things.
Yeah.
But actually not wanting to use that power in that way. Really interesting. I saw your piece about Donald Trump, and I thought it was really interesting to sort of think about Trump not only within in himself, but within this larger formation of white nationalism, and then to think about the global consequences of that formation.
That was the first one I wrote on that, trying to move in that direction. Yeah.
Very interesting work. I love that scaling, the sort of consequences of particular locals, as Doreen Massey was talking about. You know, that kind of sense that the local is not always innocent. And Arturo Escobar talks about that, doesn't he? And it's really important to think about different locals and how those different locals have different effects on the global. Really nice work.
I find, though, I like your question a lot about climate because, it's a global problem. And we know that, of course, it is, articulated in specific kinds of ways, differently. But it is this interesting moment and for possibility, and I'm not overly hopeful about things right now. Mm-hmm. But there is this possibility of us seeing ourselves as a whole, or at least as big chunks of coming together as a whole, right? And I've been very excited about thinking about the climate justice movement and the way it has become very global. You know, people using a similar framework that is attentive to the particularities of place, in terms of just focusing on who is the most vulnerable in particular kinds of places, right? And the climate justice work, too, it's so intersectional, which I think is a great source of power and strength, and bringing together with it a whole assortment of different kinds of concerns, interests, and populations.
Yeah.
So it is this very...
Yeah.
It's... two really different things happening at the same time at the global level.
Yeah, and I think you're one of the people at the forefront of really thinking how we continue to think about the globalness of climate justice, whilst also considering that localness, you know, getting past the sort of act local, you know, what was it, act local... something global?
Think global,
act local, that's the one. Where that sort of sense that you're somebody who's really thinking about those connections, what that actually means in terms of the multiple connections between the local and the global. And I'm very interested in this idea of hope. I think it's a really important idea. Often when I look out at my students, I'm thinking, well, what's the hope for them? How do we foster hope? Because without fostering hope, they will be disabled to do the actions which will make that hope real, right? So they kind of really need to maintain the hope, but obviously it's very difficult, and they are rightly anxious, but they kind of have to. We have to believe in that future in order for that future to exist. And I feel like, I guess, as for us as geographers, it's how we can work out the kind of analysis that you're doing to be able to, from that, make some sense of climate justice movements and what they can do, as well as the restrictions, of course. I've been thinking a lot with conjunctural analysis recently because I'm heading a Stuart Hall archive project at the University of Birmingham, where they are... finally putting their money where their mouth is in relation to Stuart Hall and the whole history and past. But the that it's made me rethink and be thinking again about conjunctural analysis and what we mean by it, and having to get to a more than human conjunctural analysis, you know, because Stuart Hall was obviously very concerned about nuclear in the 1980s and 90s. He was very involved with CND, so he was very much a scholar activist. But obviously now the big existential crisis is climate change, and I think my part of the project is about taking his legacy forward. And that legacy then would be about how do we deal with the existential crisis? What's our responsibility now? What should we be doing and talking to people about? And I feel like, you know, it's getting that conjunctural analysis to understand more than the human, to stop being, to not be completely anthropocentric, and to get a sense of what the earth is doing alongside. Yeah.
I'm very aware of the time.
Yes.
And you both have fantastic questions to each other that we haven't touched on yet, and I also want to have an opportunity for questions, so I'll leave it up to you. Do you want to pick up on the question of
I want to ask the one about the discipline.
You want to ask that one. Okay, great. Yeah. All right, so go ahead.
So in 2002 I was on a career break for my first child, and I was coming back to the discipline of geography. And your 2002 paper, Reflections on a White Discipline, was really important, because I was thinking about, what am I coming back to? Mm-hmm. Do I want to come back to that? Do I want to? Because I had also been in some other disciplines, had lots of temporary posts in political science and things. So I was thinking, well, where do I want to be? And I kind of thought I wanted to go back to geography, but then your paper really crystallized why that was difficult, you know. You know, what was at stake, and why, what was causing me problems in getting back to geography. So I wondered whether you could reflect on that a little bit, that moment, and then how much do you think has changed, or do you think anything's changed since 2002?
So I too had a really hard time. I mean, I feel like I am very deep in my soul. I am a geographer, but I've had a very hard time being in geography departments, you know? So I've been part of AG, you know, started attending that and becoming a part of that when I started graduate school, so very early on. And, you know, there were just very few of us there who were interested in race, who were not white, and, you know, we're a small little group. And I think I wrote this piece kind of really trying to articulate just like how difficult this was and how might the problems of it, you know, that came from being such an overwhelming like discipline, both in terms of our scholarship, but just in also in terms of the nature of the AAG and the larger community of geographers, you know, what that was like, and, you know, how we can do things differently, or should at least attempt to do so. And so I think it has changed. I think it absolutely has changed. Not where we need to be, but I mean, the fact that we have this thing called Black geographies, I mean, that was simply unimaginable, you know, 20 years ago. Latinx geographies, indigenous geographies, you know, within the AG we had, I think they had a specialty group called like the American Indian Specialty Group. And then that shifts to become the indigenous specialty group. And I think that says a lot there about the transition that was happening of Native people coming in, and they're just taking a very different approach to indigenous, you know, geographies. And I don't know if there was ever like an African-American specialty group. I doubt it, you know, but just the whole emergence of Black geographies has been really, really powerful. It has been synergistic. And it has, you know, really given rise to, I think, a very different landscape in geography. I don't know what it's like here with the IBG and the different organizations that you all have here, but I think it's profound. And I have seen the difference in the number of students of color, Black students, Indigenous students coming in, which has been, you know, really, really gratifying. But just the organizations, and then most importantly, the recognition of the importance of these things.
Yes.
Right, that has been the most, I think, powerful thing that we have seen. Yeah. You know, I'm no longer talking to like, you know, a blank wall or something like
that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, that's true. Black geographies has been enormously significant, hasn't it? And I think really interesting for you to make the connection with Indigenous geographies and, you know, other groups as well. But we've had a similar movement, I guess, in the Royal Geographical Society, starting from the Women in Geography Study Group back in the kind of 1980s, 1990s, to moving on to the kind of race group that we now have, which is a working group of the RGS. So yeah, that definitely having that an institutional place marker is really important. It doesn't necessarily change practice in all geography departments,
true,
of course, but it does. It does mean that, as you say, there's a legitimacy to talking about race that there perhaps wasn't before in geography, and that that is really important. It's really important change.
I am going to open it up for questions. I know we don't have very long, so can we take a couple of questions and see what Laura and Pat would like to respond to? Yes.
And I just was thinking about what you just said about the emergence of black geography as an incredibly powerful part of the discipline now, I think. But what I'm interested in, both of what you think about taking forward this idea of geographies of white supremacy, and then kind of what kind of work needs to be done in geographies of whiteness, I guess, kind of looking, picking up your thoughts about the histories of the disciplines where it is now. What is that a future that needs to be taken in a different direction?
I certainly think so. So I actually now, I'm in an ethnic studies department, and I'm really frustrated by my colleagues' lack of interest in studying whiteness and white supremacy. And I understand there's reasons for that, but I feel we ignore it at our own peril. I think it's a very powerful force shaping the world today, and related to that, the right, and I think those are things that we all need to be thinking about and talking about. There is within geography, I don't know if it's in, well, I guess there's a little bit of work that I know of in the UK, but within the US context, there is a little bit more work focused on whiteness, I think, and I think that's, I appreciate that work very much, and I hope it keeps growing and developing, you know. And so far, it's been primarily white people doing that work, which on the one hand I think is good, that is their work to do, but I also think it's all of us are so impacted by it that we all might be thinking about it, you know. And I do think also that, you know, people of color might have a different take on it in some ways than what white geographers would. So yeah, I encourage everybody to be studying that.
It's interesting that I think in the 1990s and 80s, when I was doing my PhD in the 90s, there was quite a lot of white studies happening, an interdisciplinary movement. What's his name? Dyer.
Yes. White Dyer? No. Owen Dyer.
Is that Owen? And I remember reading that work and finding it really interesting, but nicely kind of critical. Ron Ware doing some lovely work on kind of feminism and whiteness. So I feel like there was a kind of movement there, a kind of interdisciplinary movement, and then I think it got, I seem to remember a kind of moment where it got sort of mixed up with a sort of folkish type thing, where it got sort of a bit taken over by people who were wanting to insist on whiteness and to kind of, you know, take it through folk movements, and people were like, oh no, that's not what we want to do. So there was a lot of kind of backing off from whiteness. I think it probably does have that troubling history of being a little bit, as you say, kind of ethnic studies, then sort of places it within a kind of Englishness studies, which there's actually nothing wrong with Englishness studies, but it does kind of have those sorts of offshoots towards kind of a racism apologist type movement. So there's just that, but I think it's really important to study it. There's been that continuing stuff about race and geography, you know, from the stuff that kind of Peter Jackson's been doing for was doing a long time ago, but all the stuff that's about kind of xenophobia in Europe, all that lovely stuff that in kind of the 1990s, that was about the build-up to the EU being a fortress Europe and all of that kind of stuff. So there's always been that stuff that's been carrying on all the time and hasn't necessarily needed a sort of institutional marker, but has been very, very valid work about right-wing movements and across Europe and the rises of fascism. People like Anoop Naik doing that work consistently with white working class communities, you know, thinking about how the appeal of those kinds of ideas. So that kind of work at the kind of local scale, whereas I think your work kind of connects everything up in a kind of at the global scale in terms of, whereas that work of sort of thinking about the localness and whiteness and certain types of fascist appeal, that's been going on a long time, I think.
You know, when students ask me in my classes, like, well, what can I do in terms of like fighting racism? I could tell my students, you have to go work in your communities. You know, that is your work to do. It's not my work to do because of the way I would be received, but that is, I think, the work of a big chunk of the work of white people, yeah.
We have time for one more question, if anybody wants to pose one. Yeah.
So I spent a long time in the United States, and I became preoccupied with the classification, the ongoing classification of groups of people, and you mentioned Chicanos, Latinx, and et cetera. And I looked at the history, and it's been part of the construction of the nation of the United States, and you see it in the census, et cetera. And when I speak to activists, scholar activists in the US, they say, well, we need umbrella terms in order to unify struggles, et cetera. But then I also think about the legacy of colonialism, which is precisely the categorization of people through those umbrella terms. If there is a legacy of the colonial experience, it's precisely the birth of race and racism. And so I guess my question is, do you think the scholar activist movement in the United States, it's sort of mimicking this idea of this idea of categorizing people as a way to subvert the very issue of racism, but actually strengthening it in the process?
I don't think it's strengthening it in the process. I appreciate your rooting it in colonization, you know, and I wouldn't say it's only rooted in colonization, because in the United States, I think so much of it comes from slavery and developing, you know, elaborate kinds of categorizations of enslaved people and black people and things like that. So we have a multiple set happening in the US of categorizations. You know, that's a really interesting question. I feel that, you know, at this point, that's actually an argument that like sometimes is made on the right, is like, if we want to end racism, we should stop talking about we should stop talking about race or different kinds of racial categories. And I'm not convinced that's gonna get us where we need to be at this point in time. I think we're still at a point we need to be calling it out. And you know, one could argue we still are using the master's tools, and maybe a more creative person could see their way out of it, but I don't really see how that's happening right now. And maybe it's just such an artifact that we're all so deeply embedded, you know, in those things that we can't see different ways. So I don't know, that's a good question.
No, and because I think a lot about this through Stuart Hall, precisely, that you mentioned, then, you know, it's all of the sort of the grammar around race and our ability to read the world through grammatical sort of structures. And so the question really comes from that, from how do we sort of penetrate the grammar in a way that does not end up reproducing the same the same issues at the end. So it's just,
so I think that's about, I think it's about how you talk across those categories, right? Because I think the category itself, the self-definition as a particular kind of person or a particular kind of ethnicity or a particular gender, you know, and obviously that's multiplying as well, a particular, you know, so I think that that's quite an important moment for a lot of people to self-identify
yes.
as somebody that they want to be.
Mm-hmm.
And to be able to have the freedom to do that seems to me really important for nobody else to be able to say, no, that's not who you are. That's not a thing. You know, you actually have to be able to say, yes, it is. This is who I am. That's quite important. But then I don't think that should be where the conversation ends. You know, to you shouldn't then become trapped in that identity. To say, since I'm now Chicana, I'm trapped in being Chicana. You should be able to move out of that and through it and around it to have conversations, as we were saying before. To be able to move across identities and talk across identities, and that I think is very Stuart.
So. We are out of time, and we just have to thank Laura and Pat so much.